Hey everybody, it's Neil Rosen. Once again, another thrilling, dare I say exciting, fascinating episode of Sitting Around Talking Movies. I am joined, as always, by Bill Bregoli.
Hi there.
And joining me this week for the first time on the podcast, from Entertainment Weekly magazine, my friend Chris Nagyawadi.
Hey, hey Neil, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Bill McCuddy is off this week. So, if first-time listener, well, we're going to be talking about Finding Dory, the sequel to Finding Nemo. We're going to be talking about coming new to on demand this week and on DVD. Hello, my name is Doris. That's the Sally Field comedy slash drama. I'm going to be talking about a movie called No Stranger Than Love with Alison Brie and Colin Hanks. And we're going to be talking about, also new to on-demand and DVD, 10 Cloverfield Lane and 45 Years, which features an Academy Award-nominated performance this year from Charlotte Rampling, also stars Tom Courtney. First time listening to the show, as I was about to say, this is sort of an after-show to Talking Pictures, which is a TV show we do on New York One locally in New York, and it airs nationally on Time Warner Cable, although soon there is no really technically anymore Time Warner Cable, is there? It's now Charter.
What did you do to it, Neil?
What did I do to Time Warner Cable? It's Charter Communications and it's Spectrum, although your bills are still saying Time Warner Cable.
And they're still too high.
Right. There's still commercials that run for Time Warner Cable, but technically that company does not really exist anymore. But we are, for now, airing nationally on Time Warner Cable, soon to be Spectrum Charter Communication. All right, let's start talking about Finding Dory. Okay, so this is the sequel to Finding Nemo, which came out 13 years ago, which is really a long time to wait for a studio to make a sequel. It's Pixar, but, you know, up until a few years ago, Chris, Pixar wasn't really making sequels. I mean, if you think about it, other
That's
than
right.
the Toy Story canon,
yeah.
they do like Up, and there was no sequel to Up or Ratatouille. There's no sequel
right.
to any of these unbelievable mega money-making cash cows. They just wouldn't, which I respect, they weren't making sequels.
Yeah, so, well, you know, these movies make so much money that you can't really, you know, Hollywood doesn't like to leave any money on the table. So they go back for seconds and thirds, and that's understandable. If they're going to do it, like they did with the Toy Story movies, they found a way to keep making these movies original and feel fresh.
The third is the best one.
Yeah.
I cried with my daughter
at
the end of it.
It's a pretty heartbreaking movie.
I know.
But this one, Finding Dory, I felt like was sort of a carbon copy of Finding Nemo a little bit. As much as I did like Finding Dory, I wish it was a little bit more original.
Before we get into Finding Dory, Bill Bregoli, you know,
we sat and watched it together last night.
Yes, we did. But before we get into that,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, think about these movies. Like, for a while, okay, they do like A Bug's Life. They're like, not one of my favorite Pixar films, but it made a boatload of money. We're not doing a sequel to that. Then they do, they do Monsters, Inc., which they wound up doing a sequel down the line, but there was no original plan to do a sequel for that for many years, even though it made all this money. Somewhere there was a change. Maybe it was when Disney bought Pixar, there was a change in mindset that let's start doing sequels to this stuff. I don't know. What do you think?
They did sequels to Cars, which weren't exactly.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are awful.
They learned how to do a sequel by the mistakes they made in Cars.
Right. These movies take so long to gestate and develop because of all the computer animation that goes into them that, you know, they have to keep a pretty steady stream of content coming out. Because the movies, even when they're disappointments, they make a ton of money. And so I think that, you know, they're smart to keep the product coming because kids need new films to see on a rainy day.
Right, but nobody's doing, like, WALL-E 2. You know, this
time...
Well,
give them time. They might.
This time, the cricket and the robot decide to go to...
Yeah, but that's not totally out of the realm of possibility.
Cockroach. It was a cockroach, wasn't it?
I think it was a cockroach. Yeah.
Right, that would make sense because the cockroach will survive any nuclear.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, the cockroach will be a franchise player.
That's right. We're going to see Brave 2 or I don't know. I hope not. All right, so anyway, Finding Dory. So here's what Finding Dory is about. Unlike Finding Nemo, as Chris Nagyawadi said, it is a similar formula in Finding Nemo. Was it Marlin or Martin that Albert
Marlin.
Marlin, the clownfish voiced by Albert Brooks, was searching for his son Nemo, and Dory was helping him. This one, the focus is on Dory, and she has short-term memory. She's a blue tang fish, and she all of a sudden gets a long-time memory burst that she hasn't seen her parents in many, many years. So she sets off on this perilous voyage fraught with danger to find her parents, and Marlin and Nemo come along for the ride, and there's a lot of I'd say, you know, roadblocks along the way. I don't know. Roadblocks.
There are an adventure.
Right. I wouldn't. Yeah. You know, although I was looking for a word. Since it's underwater, roadblock wouldn't work. There's a lot of corals maybe that you hit or something.
Literally, they kept bumping into things, which was one of my favorite parts because it shows how fish in captivity don't enjoy their life too much. They kept bumping into the.
That's right.
Well, not the whale. Was it? Who was in the tank?
The beluga whale or the octopus?
Somebody kept bumping into things that had bad eyesight in the marine. So anyway, they wind up at this marine life, California Marine Life Institute,
right,
which is apparently where Dory's parents are rumored to be, which is a really good running gag with Sigourney Weaver, voiced by Sigourney, playing Sigourney Weaver. I'm like, hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver, and welcome to the Marine Life Institute where we rescue fish, and, you know, and they get a lot of mileage out of that particular gag, which I like. I think it's called the comeback, you know?
The callback,
which is pretty funny. But my feeling is that whereas Nemo had a lot more grown-up humor in it, you know, that two-phase thing that these old Warner Brothers cartoons had and a lot of early Pixar movies had where there was a whole level for kids and a whole level that went over kids' heads that adults would enjoy, I think this one was less of that and more I'm going to pull on your heartstrings. And I think it succeeded on that level.
Well, here's where I'm going to disagree with you. I actually think that I think we both, I don't know, I'm getting the sense that we sort of both liked the movie but with reservations. I actually feel that there is sort of a deeper message in this movie for adults, and that's, you know, you're a parent and I'm a parent, and anytime I'm sure you've had the experience when you're at the supermarket with your kid and you turn around and they're not where you left them and you go into that panic.
Right.
And
the panic scene in this was really, didn't you think that was really well done? Which she all of a sudden realizes she's alone.
Yeah.
And it's like the animated panic. It was just really well
done. I sort of
well
connected
done.
To that a little bit. And I felt that there was, you know, some real deeper messages about having short-term memory loss and being a parent of kid with maybe learning disabilities and how, you know, maybe sometimes it turns out that Dory's disability is actually ends up being her strength because it allows her to be sort of resilient. You know, I might be reading into it too much, but I did take away some deeper stuff from it.
What do you think, Bill?
Actually, I didn't connect to a whole lot of the dialogue, and I had a horrible weekend. I worked full-time at CBS Radio News, 10 at night till 6:30 in the morning.
Because of the
Orlando
tragedy.
This past weekend, because of the Orlando thing, I was going nonstop until the screening.
Yeah.
And I nodded off.
Yeah.
I can't be blamed, but had I connected to the dialogue better, I think I would have stayed awake.
Well, you know,
you have a legitimate excuse, at least.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed the levity this weekend.
Well, you know, what struck me the most in this movie is how much more advanced the computer animation has come in 13 years since they did Finding Nemo. I mean, I was blown away by how the renderings of these fish and the ocean itself and the corals and the seaweed. And I mean, it just, I still don't think they can get humans right. I mean, when they get to this marine life center, you know, the eyes don't look that realistic. But under the water with the fish, I mean, I was just blown, really just,
actually,
I was marveling.
I like the bubbles in the short that precedes it.
Yes, there's a short that precedes every Pixar movie. And this one was called Piper, and it's about these little piping plover birds, and that looked so realistic that you wouldn't even think that it was animation. You would think that those were real.
Right, yeah.
When the surf came in, and if you ever go to the beach and you see these little things, it's like they never learned their lesson. The water comes in and they run away, and the water comes back and they run back, and then the water, it just goes on endlessly for, like, you know, hours and hours on end. You could just watch this, but I thought that looked realistic, and I just thought the fish just looked so realistic. I mean, I don't know what the next stage of this thing is. I mean, maybe you won't even be able to tell a difference between animation and live action stuff. But this was just superb in terms. It was eye popping, you know. And I was mesmerized by the look of the film. I truly was. No, is this movie in the same league as Toy Story? Well, it was co-written by the same guy who wrote Toy Story 3, and that
Andrew Stanton.
Right, and Andrew Stanton. It's funny. I ran into him at the premiere of the movie War Horse, and I told him my daughter and I cried at the end of Toy Story 3, and he said, I cried when I wrote it, which I thought was a great line.
Nice.
And this is not in the same league as Toy Story 3, or in the same league as Ratatouille, or Monsters, Inc., or Up, or WALL-E, but I still think that, you know, it's worthy, even though, as you said, Chris, it follows a similar structure to Finding Nemo. It's a search for something. You know, it's even called Finding Dory, although it's not really, well, I guess Nemo and Marlin are trying to find Dory, but Dory's really trying to find your parents. But I think it's an admirable and, you know, and worthy, it's worthy of the Pixar name, and it's an admirable sequel. It's not as good as Finding Nemo, but I think if you're a fan of Finding Nemo and you go to it, I don't think you'll be, like, massively disappointed. I mean, there's
sequels where you are
massively disappointed. You go like, oh, my God, I hated that.
I think even, you know, sort of mediocre Pixar is better than most people's triumphs. You know what I mean? I think they're that good that, you know, even their sort of B stuff is A stuff for other people.
I think it's better than mediocre.
Pixar, too?
Yeah, that I didn't like.
I don't think so.
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was the first year they released two movies in 1 year. Oh, they released Inside Out and they released The Good Dinosaur. And The Good Dinosaur, which was a really plagued Pixar film because, you know, these things take years to make. And a couple of years into it, John Lasseter, who's the president of Pixar, said this just isn't working. And they fired the director and they came in with somebody new and they kind of like redid like two-thirds of the movie, which is, millions of dollars were thrown away. And you could just see that the movie really, I dropped my pen if anybody heard a sound effect here. Thank you, Bill. The Good Dinosaur really didn't work. But I think this is better than mediocre. I think I would say, you know, on a scale of 1 to 4, I'd give this a 3, or I'd give Nemo a 4.
Right,
and 3 is pretty damn good. You know, if you want to compare this to... I'm used to
Pixar movies being 4s.
Right.
You know what I mean? So when it's a 3, it feels a little bit
disappointing. Yeah, but the Cars movies, as Bill said, they're like 1s, 1.5s. You know, I don't like the Cars movies at all, you know. But there's so many Pixar movies where I walk out, like Ratatouille, for example, and I just, from a visual standpoint and from just the content, there's a scene in Ratatouille where... I think it's voiced by Peter O'Toole. He's a restaurant critic, and he gives a whole rap, being a critic myself, on what it's like to be a critic and when you discover that one obscure thing. And he's talking about food, but I know we've all had that experience with movies when you find that obscure movie that most people don't know about and you just can't wait to really just tell people about it, and you have the forum as a critic to do that. It really makes the whole thing worthwhile, you know, more so, I think, than seeing something terrible and just saying, stay away from this, which also has its merits, but it's just finding that undiscovered gem. There was a movie called Welcome to the Dollhouse once. It's a Todd Solondz movie. Nobody had ever heard of Todd Solondz. And I think Heather Matrizano was the lead actress. And she was nobody, and he was nobody. And I saw this thing months before, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is great. And I just, you know, kind of like was carrying the flag to say, you got to check this movie out.
Yeah, walking through the town square with your bell. Just everyone see Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Right. So, you know, this is not, there's no scene in this like a Ratatouille scene.
I don't think you need to turn people on to Finding Dory. I think they will find it on their own.
I think they will
find it in the Happy Meals and everywhere they go.
Exactly.
So that's the other thing.
Yeah, it'll make a ton of money. And I give Disney and Pixar credit. It's a 3D movie, and they showed it to us in 2D. I don't know if you saw a different screen than I did.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah, I hate 3D except for Avatar and maybe the Jungle Book.
You know? I think they overuse it. And, I've always sort of been a proponent of this theory that they should only put out one 3D movie a year, like something that's truly special that deserves to be in 3D, like Avatar or Gravity or recently The Jungle Book. And I just, you know, I mostly it's just annoying 3D.
Well, do you like 3D, Bill?
No. Yeah. And most of the time, I remember when 3D first came out and everybody was saying, you know, we're not going to poke your eyes out or anything with this. We're going to be very subtle and put you in the scene. And after a while, you get used to it, and you're in the scene, you don't care anymore. I wish somebody would poke my eyes out. Yeah. I'd like to do an old-fashioned... Remember there was a thing with Chesty Morgan called... what was that called?
I wasn't expecting to take a detour into Chesty Morgan.
I'm going to take a detour to Chesty Morgan and talk... Back in the old days when they were exploitation films... They went and exploited you, and it was fun.
Yeah, or they used to have the paddle ball, and they used to hit it out at the camera.
Well, it was. You can't see me on this podcast, but it was like, you know, it was these things that would come right at the camera, and it would look like something was coming, like you're saying, right at you. But for the most part, my theory on 3D movies is this, is that Avatar, which James Cameron knew what he was doing and really kind of reinvented this 3D whole thing, and because he... Every scene was built around making it look like an immersive experience in 3D. And because that movie became the highest grossing movie of all time, I think a lot of people said to themselves, and we talked about this last week, I am repeating myself, that, they charge more for a 3D movie, and the public seems to like this. So let's convert our regular movie, which was shot in 2D, into 3D. And one of the first ones to do that after Avatar was Alice in Wonderland, which was people went because, oh, another 3D movie, and they were very disappointed. And so many of these 3D movies that come out are conversions, and they are not exciting. I mean, I think Hugo is a decent example of a 3D movie, but you could count them on one hand. Hugo, Avatar, The Jungle Book, which is the
Gravity,
one used, great Gravity. I mean, there's just a handful of them. You know, I mean, even you know, Vincent Price's House of Wax. You know, is what they. You know, that's the boo scare effect that you were talking about. A lot of these look like these 1950s. You know,
well, I'm surprised they haven't done more horror movies in 3D, actually. I think that's one of the genres where it actually works best. These kids' movies, it's all and well, but, you know, these tickets are really expensive. The upsell for 3D,
it gives you a headache.
Really
you wear glasses. I wear glasses. I got to put the 3D.
Glasses.
So I got to put the 3D glasses over my glasses, and it gives me, like, sort of like a vertigo thing when I walk out of the theater for, like, a little while. It actually gives me a headache. And I was so thrilled last night that it was, like, great. It's not in 3D, you know. It's
plus, I always seem to have, like, a smudge on my glasses that I can't quite get out. You know what I mean? So just the whole experience.
When I want to look at my watch. I don't know whether to look at my watch through my glasses or take all my glasses off.
Before we move away from Finding Dory, I did like Ed O'Neill in the movie as the voice of an octopus.
Yeah.
Or a septopus. He only had seven.
Septopus, that's right, because he had lost one of his,
tentacles.
Tentacles, yes. And
Idris Elba has a sea lion, a cockney sea lion.
Right, Ty Burrell from Modern Family is in the thing.
As a beluga whale.
And
the parents of Dory are, who is it? It's Diane Keaton and...
Was that Bill Hader?
No, the dad is played... it'll come to me. But it's really... There are a lot of really talented voices in this movie.
Neil reaches out for his phone.
I'm going to find out for you.
Research check right now.
Right, we're going to find out.
The dad was good. I liked the dad.
Yeah.
Finding Dory, was played by... I don't know. Was it Eugene Levy?
It was Eugene Levy. Yes,
that's exactly who it
was.
All right. Well, it's on my IMDb, not on my not out of my brain, and it wasn't. So you had a little Dory short-term memory loss. Yeah. All right. So I think I liked it better than you, Chris, and you.
Bill fell asleep because
of that horrific.
I may fall asleep now, so we gotta keep going.
Yeah. Well, that was I don't want to make this show about Orlando, but what a horrific thing. I mean, that's just, I can't believe that we could even talk about these frivolous things in the light of such a tragedy like that. I mean, you know, it just puts things in perspective. I mean, you know, you're going to see Finding Dory after working on this just unspeakable, unthinkable thing.
It's probably exactly what you needed, right?
I was looking forward to it. And I think this weekend people will stop worrying, stop... freaking out and go in the theater and say, let's trust everybody that we'll be okay and watch a nice movie.
It's just horrifying. All right. Anyway, I want to talk about a movie that I missed when it came out in theaters a number of months ago, and now it's on demand, and it's also on DVD. And by the way, Chris... as I said, we do this. We did a TV show before this. My DVD arrived yesterday. Did your DVD arrive?
No, I never got it.
Oh, okay.
Never got it.
So the movie is Hello, My Name Is Doris, and it's with Sally Field. And what it's about is Sally Field plays this. I don't know how old is she, Chris?
I would guess late 60s,
like 69 or something like that. And her mother just passes away, and she had devoted most of her life to taking care of her mother, certainly the last number of years. And she's the oldest person that works in this firm. Somebody on the show said they thought it was an advertising agency.
Yeah, it's like a young, cool corporate environment,
right? And you know, she bumps literally bumps into this guy in the elevator, played by Max Greenfield, from
New Girl.
Right, from New Girl. And she develops a crush on this hot-looking young guy. And she...
Because he's very nice to her, too.
Yeah, it's like, oh, hi, Doris, how you doing? Can I help you with that? Oh, you know, let me help you with those packages. Or, you know, whatever. He's just being very lovely and nice. And there are these great fantasy sequences, which you don't know are actually fantasy sequences. They keep tricking you, which I think is wonderful. Like, all of a sudden, Doris, I know this is out of line, but I'm really attracted to you. Do you feel the same way? And you're going, what? And all of a sudden, it's like
he's just standing there, you know, and it's like, right. That never happened. And they keep going to this well, talk about the callback, they keep going to this fantasy sequence well, but she decides that she wants to get this guy. And, you know, and she starts ingratiating herself into Brooklyn hip communities. She creates a her granddaughter creates a fake Facebook page. She doesn't really even know how to use Facebook, with a fake identity, and she starts, he accepts her as a friend, this fake person who he doesn't know. So she starts to spy on his life, realizes that he likes electronic music. She buys the CD of this band that he likes and puts it on her desk. Oh, you like this band? You know? Goes, just shows up at a concert because she's reading his Facebook page that he knows she's going to be at. And all of a sudden, she becomes this quirky, wacky, you know, how would you describe it?
Well, the sort of gag is that she's so square that she's kind of hip.
Right.
Right? You know, these Brooklyn guys.
Her outfits are retro, but she's not doing it retro hip. She's just wearing these crazy old outfits.
That's right, yeah. And they think she's, you know, what other people would wear is ironic. She wears deadpan.
Right.
So,
do they think she's being ironic, or do they think she's being hip?
I think they think that she's cool, because they're so young, they don't get that this was once.
Right. In 1953, this was like a great outfit to wear, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, yeah.
So, it's a very I think Sally Field's terrific in this movie. It's a really good part for her. I think the movie's a little broad. Some of the comedy's a little broad in it, a little too broad for my taste, frankly. But Max Greenfield's always good. I like him on that New Girl show, even though I stopped watching it about a season ago because it was getting too repetitive. But he's always good. And I think this is the perfect movie for on demand. You know, it's not a movie that you necessarily need to spend, you know, $10 to see, but on demand is sort of a lower bar maybe, and I think that it's a real pleasant surprise.
I love the movie, and the reason that it fires on all cylinders for me is Sally Field's performance. I mean, despite her being an Oscar-winning actress, I mean, I had no idea that she was capable of doing this type of role. I mean, it's this weird, quirky, offbeat, even the way her glasses are like not even centered on her face, they're kind of like off to, like on an angle, and she's delightful, quirky, and
very
real.
Very funny. It's a comedy with a lot of heart, and it's not a role that she gets to play very often.
I think she deserves an Oscar nomination for this. I mean, you know, I truly do. She, you know, I genuinely feel for this woman and her crush, and that she can't really do much about it. And yeah, you feel bad. I mean, when she, you see like her attempts and her failed attempts, you know. And you know what's interesting about this movie is there a decent looking guy, a guy by the name of Stephen Root, plays her brother, and you just can't believe that this guy played Milton in Office Space.
Oh, right.
You know, he's the guy that's nice. My stapler, and don't move my desk.
You got, that's a pretty good imitation.
You know, and it's amazing. This
ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Root has entered the radio.
Thank you. Overweight and nerdy, and just a complete lame mess. And he's like this cool guy, you know. And he was also in a couple episodes of 24, the Kiefer Sutherland show. Mm-hmm. But he's really good. I highly recommend My Name Is Doris, and I like the ending. And when I say the ending, I'm talking about the last 5 seconds because it's ambiguous. And they used to do that a lot in the 60s. Like, if you look at the end of The Graduate, I'm not comparing this to The Graduate, but, you know, Elaine and Benjamin get on the bus, and it's like, what's going to happen next? And it leads to discussion, and, you know, you could think of, like, gee, what is going to happen next? Which is why they ruined the Broadway play, because they actually showed you what was going to happen next, which was terrible. I don't know if you saw the play.
I did not.
With Jason Biggs, and I think it was it Kathleen Turner? I don't know. Anyway, that was awful, but I like the ambiguous ending, and I highly recommend, if you want to see a good film, Hello, My Name is Doris, on demand and on DVD. Also out there is an Academy Award nominated performance this year from Charlotte Rampling called 45 Years. Why don't you, Bill or Chris, why don't you tell us about it?
Okay. It is about this couple that's been together for 45 years. They are played by Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtenay, both of whom, have been acting for a very long time. Tom Courtenay, probably best known from The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, Billy Liar, a lot of British movies from the 60s. He was in Dr. Zhivago. Charlotte Rampling, of course, everyone knows. They play a couple that's been together and have a very nice life in the English countryside. Everything seems to be fine. They've got this big anniversary party coming up. And just as they're about to celebrate this party, he gets news that the girlfriend he was hiking with before he met his wife, his previous girlfriend, who had died during their hike and was frozen in ice, has been found.
Because of climate change.
Right.
The glaciers are melting.
Right, okay. Right. They don't hammer that too hard in the movie.
Slight subtle echo message.
And the sort of revelation that this woman seems to come out of the past, and it creates a wedge in their relationship where it's sort of like a ghost has arrived in their relationship, and you know, they need to sort of reevaluate where they are as a couple. It's fascinating stuff. It's beautifully acted by both actors, and I was really moved by it. I thought it was terrific, the fact that you can spend 45 years with someone and maybe not know everything about them, not know as much as you think you do.
I was married once, and it freaks you out when you learn. I was only married for 6 years, but after a few years, you start to learn about this person that you're most intimate with, and when you find out something you didn't know before,
right.
You get and all those feelings came back to me while I was watching this.
Yeah, it's really grown-up, sophisticated entertainment, you know, and it's understated performances. I think Charlotte Rampling is incredible. I mean, there's no like big dramatic, you know, emotional outburst scenes.
There's a lot that's unsaid.
It's all done with like a raise of an eyebrow or just like a look in her eye or just an expression on her face. It's really subtle acting, and Tom Courtney also just really, really well done. Both of them just tremendous. And I think that, you know, it's all slight gestures. And I think that, you know, there's a lot to be learned here. You know, it's a smart, intelligent film that, you know, it's greatly elevated by the high caliber acting. And it really says a lot about long-term marriage. You know, that, like, you know, you said you were only married for 6 years. I'm married for almost 30 years. But how long are you married, Chris?
8 years.
Yeah, but, you know, it's ups and downs, you know, and you just see, like, they had this routine and, you know, it's kind of like a wrench is thrown into the fire there, and she's like, you know, and it's not, I mean, it's a ghost. Like, it's not like there's another woman that he's fooling around with, but I mean, he's looking at the slides up in the attic from, like, you know, he's pining away from her. The fact that she was found, and he's the next of kin, because, well, I used to live with her. We pretended that we were married so we can get into place. I mean, you know, it's a very intelligent, smart movie, and, you know, there's a great little moment when the movie, the song Young Girl, Get Out of My Mind, comes on the radio, and she just immediately turns off the radio in the car, you know what I mean? It's like, Young Girl, Get Out of My Mind. And there's little subtle touches like that that are just, even their anniversary party, which is what they're planning. I mean, if you look at that scene, I mean, what you're seeing and what the dialogue is and what's really going on in the minds, it's really hard to convey that from an acting sense, but you just see that in Charlotte Rampling's face. Would you agree?
Yeah, as I said, it's the unsaid stuff that an actor can do, a raise of an eyebrow just to internalize something, that I really love in movies.
Yeah. So here's a really crappy film that is new to On Demand this week. It's called No Stranger Than Love. To put it simply, everybody in this town loves Alison Brie, who plays a character called Lucy. Everybody loves her. The hardware store guy, the cop, the town cop, I don't know, everybody, I love you. You know, I love you. But she decides to have an affair with Colin Hanks, who's a married guy, which, by the way, they have no chemistry, which doesn't make any sense. She's very attractive in the movie. Why she would pick this particular guy, it's never explained, but nothing is really explained in this movie, including 10 minutes in, that there's a giant hole that opens up in the floor of her living room, and he falls into the hole, and she could talk to him, but he can't get out of the hole. She goes in the basement. It's like this mysterious, magical thing, and there's not much more to the movie than that. I mean, I like the first 10 minutes before he fell in the hole. I'm going, where is this going? But everybody loves Lucy, and I didn't love Lucy, and the only I Love Lucy I like is the one with Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball.
Yeah, I don't love Lucy that one so much either, but this movie's terrible. It's just a bad concept, and you can imagine them coming up with this story and thinking, oh, this is so clever. We're going to have him sucked into this black hole, and it's going to be a metaphor for I don't know what. I still couldn't tell you, but it's just a not very good movie. Alison Brie, of course, is from Community. She's winning and delightful.
She's good, but she's not enough to carry.
But she's not a leading actress, to me at least, and I think this movie is devoid of any charisma on the part of any actor, which is the least of its problems, but it's a problem. And I think, you know, the whole idea of this black hole sucking Colin Hanks into the film, you know, the movie itself gets sucked into this black hole as soon as it appears, and it never finds its way out.
You know, it just didn't work, and it's hard to pull off this bizarre, offbeat, farcical kind of comedy. You've got to really know what you're doing. Somebody mentioned on
you have
the TV
to be smarter
show today,
than this.
Like Charlie Kaufman could do.
Yeah.
like being John Malkovich or something. I mean, that's an absurd idea, but if you really are smart and know how to do it, which is very difficult to do, you can pull it off. And these people just don't know what they're doing. So concept-wise, yes, it could have worked if the writing was better and the situations were better, but it wasn't. One more movie before we go, and that is 10 Cloverfield Lane, which was in theaters. It's not really a sequel to Cloverfield, although in a slight way there is a little similarity. But I didn't like Cloverfield, and I really liked 10 Cloverfield Lane. Why don't you tell us, one of you guys, you want to tell us what it's about, Bill?
This young woman has a spat with her boyfriend in
Ben.
The car.
Ben right. is her boyfriend.
Ben, the unseen boyfriend. Right. And all of a sudden, she's in a car accident. She wakes up. She's in a bunker with John Goodman, which is scary enough.
Right.
And then someone else comes in the bunker. But he tells them, look, you can't go outside because strange things are happening and aliens are taking over.
Or it's a nuclear holocaust
or
something.
Yeah. Right. Strange stuff is happening. You can't go outside. They don't really believe him. And there's reason enough not to believe him because he's strange.
Right. Well, she wakes up. She's chained to the wall. She's got an IV in her.
But it's for her own good, he says.
Right, right. Yeah. And you're not showing me any gratefulness because I saved your life, you know. And he's just acting like a real weird guy, like, there's another guy that's in this basement also, and she touches the guy's hand, and he's like, how dare you disrespect? I mean, he's a lunatic. So
and
you
he talks about a daughter that you're not really sure.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of ambiguity in the movie, and I think Goodman is actually the strongest thing in the film. J.J. Abrams, of course, produced this movie, and he's sort of the creative maestro behind the whole Cloverfield, you know, franchise slash universe, and you know these movies, like a lot of J.J. Abrams movies, sort of exist to be a little bit of a tease. They're like Twilight Zone episodes where you know there's a twist coming, you just wonder where it's going to be and what it's going to be. To me, the buildup in the bunker was interesting. The paranoia, the claustrophobia, who can I trust, what's going
yes,
on outside.
Yes,
a lot of that's very interesting, but I just didn't sign on to the twist.
I agree. Yeah. I'd say 85% of the movie, it's like, is John Goodman a lunatic? What's going on? Is he telling the truth that the world is being taken over by aliens or chemical warfare? Or right, and is she going to get it? Like, that was all very interesting to me. And I won't do a spoiler here, but right, but the ending also, when we got to find out whether that was true or not and what happened, I was also disappointed with the end. But I do like the film. It's like a B horror movie with great production values and a really good cast. Goodman is terrific in it.
He's
and
usually
so
in a movie for 5 minutes, and he goes away. Like Llewellyn Davis, he's wonderful in that. He kills.
Right.
But he goes away, and you wanted to see more of him. This, you get to see him for most of the movie.
And I always like Mary Elizabeth Winstead. I think she's quite good, too.
Yeah, she's very
good.
She's also in Brain Dead, which you can check out on CBS. So
yeah.
Put in a plug for
it. Okay. And I didn't know where it was going, for most of the movie. I'm like, what, you know, what's going on? And that's good. I mean, you know, we see a lot of movies.
It is. But look, it's also very frustrating, too. I mean, these movies are a leap of faith. And when they leave you disappointed, it can sort of ruin the whole experience, at least for me. I felt this movie, as much as I enjoyed a lot of it, to me, it felt like a second-rate, sort of second-tier M. Night Shyamalan movie, like Signs.
Ugh.
You know what I mean? It's really good build-up, and then I found the sort of
You can't say what it is.
Sting in the tail to be a little disappointing.
Yeah, I'm with you, but I did enjoy the ride up until we got to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And would you recommend? It's on DVD and on demand.
Would you recommend it
for a $5.99 or $4.99 rental on demand?
I would, yes.
Okay, what about you?
Yeah,
Bill?
Absolutely. It's worth more than $4.99 even. I wouldn't pay full price to see it in the theater, but for $5, it's a great
And usually in these B-type movies, like the structure of this, you don't get these kind, like I said, you don't get these kind of performances. You get like these, you know, mediocre actors, and Goodman is really good in this, and so is she. And you know, with the house also, usually if you have a B movie like this, the house would not be designed as well as the production design in this particular film. So. But I liked it. The key to me is, I agree with you. The ending was disappointing, but up until that point, I enjoyed it. Well, anyway, thanks for sitting around talking movies with us. Next week, we'll be sitting around talking movies again, and a whole bunch of stuff in theaters and on demand, so we'll see you next week. Thanks a lot.